Well, this week we've come to the end of our brief look at Jeremiah, the man, the times in which he lived, and the words of God that he delivered to the people of Jerusalem. If you've been here for the last couple of weeks, you'll have a pretty good idea of the setting of Jeremiah's life. As a young man, he was called by God to be a prophet, and although at first reluctant, Jeremiah preached a message of judgment upon Jerusalem and the surrounding country. Effect of many years during the rulers. When the rulers were bad rulers over the people. The religious leaders, the political leaders, they were all a bad lot, and the people were turned away from God. Jeremiah first preached this message when there seemed very little prospect of judgment, very little prospect of any of the threats that he pronounced coming true. But last week we heard about the final years of the 7th century BC, which were a time when Jerusalem's fate was held very much in the balance. She paid the price for forming alliances with a superpower which was on the way down, and so invoked the wrath of the winning side. Jeremiah's threats seemed that much more real once this had happened, and although it made them no less palatable to the people. The religious authorities, well, they had him whipped and put in stocks for what they saw as incitement and sedition, behaviour likely to give comfort to the enemy. When we come to what we read this week, Jerusalem had really just about had it. 10 years earlier, the Babylonians had marched against the city when the king of Judah had rebelled against them and refused to pay the tax that had been agreed by a treaty. The king of Judah was assassinated by opponents who blamed him for the mess the nation was in, and he was replaced by his son, who was smart enough to surrender when the Babylonians came knocking at his door. The young king, his mother, the court officials, and many of the top people in the city were transported off to Babylon, along with a large proportion of the national treasure. The king's uncle, Zedekiah, took the throne in the absence of his nephew, detained elsewhere at his Babylonian majesty's pleasure. Zedekiah's position wasn't an easy one, although he did make rather a mess of what little chance he had to keep the nation on an even keel. Judah had lost many of its most able people. A number of its major cities had been destroyed or severely damaged. It was economically crippled, and those nobles who remained to assist King Zedekiah were worse than useless. Although Jehoiakim had surrendered to the Babylonians and been forcibly removed from Jerusalem, there were many who still regarded him as the legitimate heir to the throne of David. Zedekiah was forced to go along with whatever the nobles suggested, for fear that they would get someone else to do the job if he didn't toe the line. Zedekiah reigned for 10 years, remarkably, but the nation was never secure during all of that time. Halfway through that period, there had been a Jewish revolt in Babylon, and Zedekiah was forced to make peace again with the Babylonians. Despite what had happened, he was still unable to resist those nobles who wanted to break free from their oppressors, and again a few years later, Judah rebelled against Babylon. The Babylonians' thirst for vengeance against this upstart nation led to Jerusalem coming under siege, and it's at that point that we join the story this evening, with Jerusalem having been besieged by a mighty enemy. Had this been a story set in a frontier town in the American West, we might have expected Zedekiah to open the prison gates and toss Jeremiah a Colt 45 so he could defend the town against the outlaws. But this wasn't the Wild West, and Jerusalem more than 600 years before Jesus was born, and Jeremiah wasn't released from prison until the Babylonian army actually entered the city. Like everyone else, the Babylonians thought that Jeremiah had been on their side, and they gave him the choice of returning to Babylon or staying in Jerusalem. Jeremiah stayed in the city, although through circumstances beyond his control, he ended up with a faction of Jews who fled to Egypt. And it was there that he died. But being in prison didn't stop Jeremiah from continuing to preach his message of judgment against Judah and the king. The prison where he was held was part of a guardhouse next to the king's palace. And so he was in a handy position to keep up his calling of preaching the message of judgment against the king and his people. His message stayed exactly the same as it always had been, but now it was much harder to refute. The Babylonian army was at the city's gates, and Jeremiah told the king that God would give the city into the hands of this foreign enemy, and that he, the king, would not escape. Resistance was futile. There were various laws in ancient Israel which governed the buying, the selling, and the redemption of property. We come across an example of these laws in action in the story of Ruth. There, Naomi, the widow of Elimelech, wishes to sell a piece of land to Boaz, who rather liked her. And Boaz acts as Naomi's agent in this transaction and offers first refusal to Elimelech's nearest relative. The unnamed relative agrees to buy the land, but then Boaz reminds him that if he takes the land, he's got to take Ruth as well. She comes as part of the package. The relative has a rather ungallant change of mind and backtracks on his decision at this point. This had nothing to do with how attractive or otherwise Ruth happened to be, although the reason still doesn't reflect well on the relative. If he was to take on Ruth as well as this land, any children that Ruth subsequently had would become heirs to the land, and this relative and his family would lose out. Let's go back to Jeremiah again, and a similar situation presented itself to him. God told him that he would be offered first refusal on a package of land in his home village of Anatoth. One of his cousins would come to him and offer to sell him a field. Jeremiah's relationship with his family had become strained since he became a prophet. Chapter 11 of his book tells us about a plot against his life which came from his relatives in Anatoth. Perhaps this offer from the cousin to sell a piece of land is part of a process of reconciliation. The circumstances surrounding the transaction are shrouded in some mystery, which gives us plenty of scope, therefore, for speculation. We've already heard how the economy of Judah was in a parlous state, with enemy action having resulted in the destruction of a number of important cities. It wouldn't be surprising if Hananiah wanted to liquidate his assets and do a runner. On the other hand, our knowledge of Old Testament property law is sufficiently sketchy to leave us wondering whether there was any pressure being applied on Jeremiah to redeem a piece of land which had been mortgaged and which was simply being returned to the family by virtue of Jeremiah paying off a debt. But this offer was presented to Jeremiah, whatever happened, and however willingly he paid the money. It didn't seem that it was much of a deal, though. The enemy was at the gates. There was the prospect of transportation to Babylon, and who knows what the Babylonians would do to farms and the countryside around Jerusalem, where this piece of land was. But the way in which this transaction is described in such detail leads us to the conclusion that we're to see more in this than simply a piece of land dealing. What was going on here, set against the backdrop of the destruction of a nation, its corporate life, its religion, its culture, was that all things would pass. There would come a time when things would grow again in Judah. There would be a time when the trees would once again bear fruit, when, as the Lord told Jeremiah, houses, fields, and vineyards would again be bought in the land. But of course, Jeremiah never lived to see his land. He bought the field in good faith as a sign that God would once again do good things in Judah. It's often the case that we have to dig and plant without ever seeing the results of our labours. We'll sometimes plant in our gardens shrubs and trees, which others who come after us will enjoy. We can't guarantee that we will live to see our children or our grandchildren's achievements. Nor can we know what will be the effect of the work we put in to developing and nurturing the work of the kingdom in our local church fellowship. And yet still we're called to dig and to plant. It's appropriate that we remember that we are called to make provision for those unnamed and unknown people who will come after us. As those who went before us have left us with their legacy, so we are called to share together in a vision for the future. And this vision is not just one of buildings and physical structures, but it's also one which may be less tangible, but which is no less real. We're called to build up women and men and children to faith in Christ and to make real God's kingdom where we are. We may see the results of what we do, but sometimes, like Jeremiah, we might buy the field but never see the crops grow, or certainly not see them come to harvest. But as in the story Jesus told of the farmer who went out to sow a field, there will be a harvest. A church that neither maintains itself nor is prepared to adapt to new times will become sidelined and at best become little more than a museum and at worst another carpet warehouse. People don't go to churches simply because there are a lot of people there. They go because they find something there which excites them. They go expectantly. They go waiting to see something happen, wanting to encounter God. The church that sets the pulse racing is one in which things happen. People go to a sports stadium to be part of a sporting event, and one of the reasons people come to church is to experience God. Without a sense of God moving in the life of the church, it will go the same way as the Bolito factory in Hatfield Road. There's something exciting about releasing a gift that we already have. The New Testament speaks of stirring up the gift that is within us. We also talk sometimes of becoming who we are, that is, people who have been redeemed. Sometimes we need to be reminded of that and live as redeemed people. The people of ancient Israel made a number of mistakes, and they paid for them when they became exiled from the land that God had given to them. But it was a piece of this land that Jeremiah bought while in his prison cell with the Babylonians at the city gates, and with little prospect of his ever getting to take possession of his field. But in telling Jeremiah to buy this land, God was saying to the people that they had a future. Mistakes, however bad, are not terminal with regard to our relationship with God. And while these mistakes can make some situations irretrievable, they don't place us outside of God's plan. Israel's sin broke forever their covenant with God so that there would no longer be a king on David's throne. But like the Persian carpet weaver, who I've told you about recently, the one who takes the mistakes of his son and weaves them into the pattern of the carpet, so God was able to use Israel. And from out of the stump of Jesse came God's son, who was to be a light to all the nations. So after all Jeremiah's unheeded warnings against Judah, after all the appalling trauma suffered by the people as some were killed, others were exiled to a foreign country, and the rest were left to scavenge in ruined cities, God still had a place in his plan for this nation. That plan would lie within them. Our passage this evening follows on from chapter 31, and there God speaks through Jeremiah and says that the days are coming when he will make a new covenant with the house of Judah. Although God took Israel by the hand and called them out of Egypt, away from the clutches of Pharaoh, the kings and the people broke the covenant. They went their own way. But God says, I'll make a new covenant with Israel. I'll put my law within them. I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. That was a prophecy for the people of Jerusalem, who would know God in a new way when they would return to the city after the exile. But that prophecy has also found fulfillment in what God has done in Jesus. Whereas the sacrifices on the altar of the temple were intended to be repeated year after year as often as necessary, The sacrifice of Jesus was once only and for all people. When Jesus died, he died for all the sins of all the people, so that men and women could have a new relationship with God, a new covenant. And Jesus promised that his Spirit would dwell among his people, never to leave them. I mentioned last week that the predominant message of Jeremiah is one of judgment. But there is also here in this story of the purchase of a piece of land a sign of hope. God has not given up on his people. Our relationship with God is dependent upon what lies within us. If we've turned to God, we've received his Spirit, and God is beside us and his Spirit is within us. If you find that your spiritual outlook is bleak, remember that God has given this new covenant. Remember that the God who's given us his Spirit to dwell within us is the God who told Jeremiah to have faith when there seemed only despair. Remember that the God who left his Son on the cross is the God who raised Jesus from the grave. Remember that the God who promised to forgive Israel is the God who's promised to remember your sin no more. Because we, his people, and you, a child created in his image, are part of God's plan. Amen.